We're going to make our way through the book of Acts. We're going to cover two chapters today because chapter 22 really is Paul's testimony, which I think is kind of familiar territory. So we'll get into chapter 23. And if you are a visitor, let me just mention that what we do is we go through what the church encourages us to be studying. And we've been making our way through the book of Acts and coming to the end here pretty soon. And then I always like to do an application, which you'll notice at the end. Today, it just seemed to me that since we are talking about both Jerusalem and Caesarea, I would come back and show some of the slides from that. Some of you said that when I presented some of it last week, it went a little fast. Well, I will cover some of that again, but also I loved some of you like the 3D animation, so I added another 3D animation. Also, a little bit about marine archaeology, because some of the things that they're digging up from the bay there in Caesarea also give us a little bit more insight. So if you have never been to Israel, this is going to be helpful. If you've been to Israel, I would still say that you'll probably learn some things that you may not have learned even if you were there. I've taken the time over the last week to watch a couple of YouTube channel videos of various guides at Caesarea. It seems like each one of them talks about different things. So now I feel like I'm learning a lot more. Matter of fact, I feel like I'm ready to actually be a guide, but that's a different story. But anyway, this is all information we're going to cover fairly quickly. And so we'll do that. And then I want to turn it back to Parker, because we've got some pictures from the Mother's Weekend, the Husband's Weekend, the men, the women, all that, and a video that you'll enjoy watching as well. So again, if you would, turn with me to Acts 22. We're going to spend a little bit of time there and then move on to Acts 23. The theme here is that God provides us with opportunities even in the midst of opposition. And what we see here is that we have, as we're coming to the end, we've seen the first missionary journey of Paul, the second missionary journey of Paul, the third. Now this last few chapters help us understand what happens when he now is taken into custody and how he has an opportunity, even in the midst of that, to present and to defend himself against the unfounded accusations of the Jews and how he appears before the Romans. So this will take us from the temple in Jerusalem to the barracks of the Romans to actually the praetorium. And I'm going to show you a picture of that, which has now been uncovered. A lot of what is uncovered in Caesarea started in 1997, as hard as that is to believe. It's been there, but we'll talk more about some of the things, even in the last couple of weeks, that have been uncovered there with some of the archaeology being done. So I think it'll be very helpful to us. But in Acts 22, we see, first of all, that here Paul is taken into custody, but just before he does so, and outside of now the barracks of the Romans, he wants to present himself. And so here, once again, we see this presentation that he does. And so he speaks in their local dialect. I mentioned last week that you have a little bit of a debate as to whether or not it was, whether he was speaking in a Hebrew dialect or something else. And certainly I think the ESV, New American Standard, King James render that it's a Hebrew dialect, so we'll go with that. But nevertheless, because of that, they are quiet for a time. These are the Jews, these are some rabble-rousers from other parts of Asia, and he then highlights his biography, and you can begin to read how he talks about being from Cilicia or Tarsus, and how he was actually an individual who came, interestingly enough, to study on one of the most prominent preachers of that time, the teacher Gamaliel. Then he shares his encounter about him actually encountering Jesus on the road to Damascus, and really emphasizes God's hand in the matter of all of this, and really an unexpected transformation. A couple of weeks ago we talked about here he's ministering to those who had actually fled from Jerusalem because Paul, at that time, Saul of Tarsus and others were persecuting them. And now the Apostle Paul is ministering to the same people that had fled from Jerusalem because of his persecution. And then no one but God could actually have accomplished this remarkable transformation. He's now called to be a witness for him to everyone of what you have seen and heard. And so he is God's witness there in that particular situation. But then we see something kind of interesting, because then as he is giving another part of his defense, the crowd sort of allows that for a while before they turn on him, and I'll explain why that took place in just a minute. But he's certainly impressing upon them this idea of wanting to still minister to the Jews. He's been ministering to the Gentiles, but he's come back to Jerusalem. It was, as we learned 2 weeks ago, when he was actually going through a ritual purification at the temple that this all takes place. So he is still wanting to do that. But obviously, God has a greater plan and wants Paul to also use the gospel to spread not only to Jerusalem and Judea, but Samaria and to the Gentiles in the othermost parts of the earth. And so we see that as well. And so, interestingly enough, he talks about references to Stephen and the stoning of Stephen, and all's going okay. I'm not saying it's going well. It's going well until he uses what word? Gentile. That's the deal breaker. And you can begin to see what happens almost instantaneously there, because as soon as he uses the word Gentiles, and you can see this in verse 21 and verse 22, up unto this word they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, "Away with this fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." It's amazing how there's trigger words that we talk about. You know, we have people that are sort of a little bit snowflakes, and they talk about trigger words. Well, this was apparently a trigger word for the Jews, the word Gentile. And now we see these vicious threats, no longer are they willing to listen to him and to hear his story. And in the midst of all of this, fortunately, the Roman Tribune is there to actually take him away. And so now we see that he is taken away and he is going to be flogged for questioning. And that's where Paul now plays, some people call it his trump card, you know. And that is, look at again, we can see this in verse 25. "Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?" Because, according to one commentary I read, it said it was illegal to submit a Roman citizen to this method of examination. So when Paul says that, the Roman Tribune actually kind of sarcastically responds, "Yeah, well, it's possible for anyone to buy their Roman citizenship." And so immediately Paul comes back and said, "No, I was born a Roman citizen." In some respects, one-upping him and illustrating how dangerous it would have been for him. It might have even been a death sentence for him if he was discovered to have flogged a Roman citizen. And so now he recognizes that here I'm dealing with somebody who, in a sense, outranks me. Yes, I'm in the Roman military. The implication is maybe he bought his Roman citizenship and he is now face to face with a man who has a Roman citizenship from birth. And so that is a good illustration, once again, how Paul, wherever he was, used whatever God placed in his hands to advance the gospel. And I think the obvious implication for us is God has placed you somewhere in a particular position in your community, in a particular position, maybe in your business. He's given you certain gifts. And we see that Paul uses those time and time again to advance the gospel. In this case, also to save from being beaten or flogged as he has been in the past. This, of course, immediately quiets the tribune and causes him to fear the repercussions of illegally prosecuting a full-fledged Roman citizen. And so, again, we can just see how he uses these platforms to advance the gospel. And I think that's really one of the great applications, even as we're going through kind of a historical novel, if you will, a historical testimony and story. It also gives us some application as we, as believers, can use some of that as well. Well, then in the bottom of chapter 22, and then going into chapter 23, we see something else. And that is the theme for this section is that Christians should live in a way that honors God and loves others. So now he finds himself before the council of religious leaders. Up until this point, he's in front of the Roman barracks. In a few minutes, I'll kind of give you a little bit of an overview of the Jerusalem and where that might have been and where that was. But now he finds himself in front of the council. That council could have been at the temple or most likely was nearby. And now the question that is being raised is, why are you bringing charges against this individual? And so the first thing we see once again is he declares his innocence. We see that in chapter 23. And now Luke has provided up until this time an account of the life of Paul. So we can see that when he says he's innocent, we don't have to guess. You know, has Paul done something that's not appropriate? Has he not been a person of integrity? Has he done something to violate Jewish law? The reason we have a belief that indeed Paul is innocent is because we up now have read 22 chapters of the book of Acts, and to see that Paul is, from the time of his conversion, blameless. And so that is certainly the important part. But immediately, again, his statement brings an immediate act of violence from the high priest. What happens? Well, he commands people to strike Paul on the mouth. So, again, this is, in some respects, a little bit reminiscent of what had happened many years before when Jesus stood, perhaps in that same spot. Remember what happened there? And so, in some respects, Luke includes that to remind us that just what happened to Jesus also now has happened to Paul. And if you're taking some notes, you might put down John chapter 15, verses 18 to 21, because this is where, you remember, Jesus warned and reminded his disciples, in particular James and John and Peter and others, that indeed those who follow him and proclaim the gospel would face some of the same things that he faced. And in some respects, Luke, I think, includes this to remind them of the fact that just as what happened to Jesus in that spot now has happened to Paul. Well, then, interesting enough, don't you love how he responds with a rebuke? Look at verse 3. God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? Those are pretty strong words, aren't they? You know, anytime you think, well, Christians are always supposed to be milquetoast, easy doormat, that's not exactly Paul. And some people even have a problem with that statement. So again, if you're taking some notes, you might put down Philippians 3, verse 2. Because in some respects, if you think Paul is kind of, you know, willing to take it and never dish it out, well, go back and read how he relates to those in Philippi. And you can see the character of his tone there. I think it matches what we see here in Acts 23. And so again, what we see is the high priest has accused Paul of lying, while Paul's response is, you are the very people that are supposed to not be lying. You're the very people that are supposed to be obeying God's will. You are the ones that have studied God's word, and yet your lives do not demonstrate that in any significant way. So again, the questioning very quickly generates into kind of a shouting match. And here is again where Paul understands sometimes how to play the trump card. What does he say? Look at verse 6. And he says, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And that has to do with the fact that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. And if you've ever been to a Christian camp, you know how you make the difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Everybody remember that? Well, the Pharisees did not believe in the resurrection, so they were sad, you see, right? Remember, ever heard that? If you haven't been to a Christian camp, that's used every year. But nevertheless, it's a good way to recognize that there is a divided group now. And so instead of him being the focus of conflict, he now causes them to be in conflict with one another. And so once again, you've got to feel sorry for this Roman tribune. He's just trying to figure out, why are you so upset with this man? He has certainly done nothing to justify this level of anger and animus and a plot to kill him. And so again, it becomes clear that just for his own safety, and due to the crazed behavior of the group, he finally removes him and returns him back to a prison, which is probably right next to the barracks. And so while he is there, we see one other thing. Look at verse 11. While he's in that prison there at the barracks, Jesus appears to him again and says what? Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. This is a foreshadowing of the fact that Paul will be taken to Rome in shackles, by the way, but nevertheless have an opportunity to take the message he's been actually declaring in Jerusalem and taking it also to Rome as well. And so then we, of course, read, starting in verse 12, a plot to kill Paul. The hatred of the Jews there grows in intensity, and they now take this religious vow, where they vow to actually fast until they kill him, which, if you don't accomplish it pretty quickly, it could be pretty dire. And I think, if nothing else, it just shows how twisted by this time the Jewish religion has become, that Paul represents such a threat to them that they are seeking to kill him. And, of course, then we read that Paul's nephew learns of the plot, informs him, and sends him to then notify the tribune so that they know there may be some kind of assault on the barracks or on the prison. And so then the tribune makes plans for Paul to travel now to Caesarea. What was Caesarea? Well, Caesarea, and we're going to look at some pictures of it in just a minute, was the Roman outpost, which looks more like Rome than any other place except Rome. It was a place so that Roman soldiers would not get homesick. They would feel like they were at home. But it is a very fortified area. And to show you how concerned he was about the possibility that there might have been an attack on his soldiers and Paul, jump ahead, if you can, for just a minute and look at verse 23. Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea on the third hour of the night and provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor." I would suggest to you that sounds a little bit like an overreaction, unless the plot to kill Paul involved virtually every able-bodied Jew who was part of this crowd. So it gives you a sense of what at this point maybe was the fear on the part of the Roman tribune of what might actually take place. Now, backing up also, before he sends there, he also pens a letter to Felix the governor and talks about how he discovered Paul's Roman citizenship. Notice in the letter he doesn't point out how he found that out. That is, almost beat this Roman citizen, and thus I would lose my life or certainly my position at the very least. But nevertheless, he talks about how he is sending to Felix the governor now in Caesarea an individual who's a Roman citizen. And so he arrived safely in Caesarea and held under guard there as well. And now Felix, in talking with him, we're now up to this particular section here, learns that he is actually from Cilicia, or what today we call Tarsus. And so what he could have done as a Roman leader is simply sent him on to his hometown and then actually stand trial there. But he decides to keep him in Caesarea instead, and some people suspect that perhaps he was concerned that it would anger the Jewish leaders if he were to send on to Cilicia or Tarsus, because at least Caesarea is in Israel. It's not a far distance from those in Jerusalem. And so instead, he is taken and now guarded. Look at our last few verses there, verse 35. "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. Well, if you've ever traveled to Caesarea, people always say, "Where is the praetorium?" And we now have pretty good evidence of where that is. It's right here. We now, this particular area was uncovered in 1997. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. But all of this area was covered over by sand. And so as they've been able to uncover this, this was considered probably the place which was the audience hall of Herod's area next to his palace. Now, we also believe that it's praetorium because as they've uncovered the stones, they have found this. The first one over here, I won't read it into the Latin here, but basically it seems to indicate that the guard there was a Latin-speaking guard, so probably, again, somebody from Rome. And so we have that particular stone that has been preserved fairly well. Even more so, apparently people even like to get their names in there. We know that one of the Christian officials over here, we know that his name is Frumentarius, so we have that as well. And so we now have in the stone itself where the Roman Praetorium was, where Paul was taken. I was watching this video this week on a YouTube channel, and one of the particular guides said, this is how he does it. He says, Paul was either standing right here in front of Felix, or he was standing right here. In other words, it's either this exact spot or it's right here, because it has to be right here. So I thought that was really interesting to see how they did that. And so for just a few minutes, I thought once again, I'd take you through a little bit of the geography and the archaeology that we have that, again, verify some of the things we're reading right today in Acts 22 and 23. The first is, as we said, Paul arrives in Jerusalem. He goes through a purification ritual that we read about a few weeks ago. And then he is taken from that particular area in the temple to a place where the barracks took place, and then later appears before the council. And so this gives you a picture, a rendition of what it may have looked like during the time in which Paul was there. And recognize we have these walls that exist. This, of course, is where the temple is. And so let's look at the temple. And since everybody loves these 3D animations, let's, you know, move our way from Hinnom Valley down to this particular place. And this gives you a sense of what the temple at that time looked like. And so this is the open area for the various others, probably where the barracks were located. But let's, if we can, look at the temple itself for just a minute, because what we have here is the entrance into that. It's quite possible that some of the teaching of Paul, maybe even Peter, took place as they stood on those steps preaching to those individuals. And we'll also, excuse me, I've got to hit another button here. Wait a minute, that one didn't, well, that one is supposed to, let's see if this one works. For reasons we don't, oh, there it is. I just was taking too long. There it is. Now, and this will be the Holy of Holies, and now I'll take you through all of this area. And that is the part for the Gentiles. The court of the Gentiles was really this location over here. And so some of the barracks may have been off to the side there. And so this is certainly where anyone could actually be part of the temple area. But only Jews could enter in through this particular gate. And as they would enter into this gate, they would be in this area here. And so it's quite possible that sometimes Paul, as he was teaching, or Peter were teaching, they would be there. The priest would be over here instead. And this is where, of course, the sacrifices were given. And that was, if nothing else, a reminder and a foreshadowing of the great sacrifice once for all for us of Christ dying on the cross. And so we'll come back and also then look at, in addition to not only the outer court, but we have the inner court. And then, of course, we have the holy place, which would be the location of the Holy of Holies. So it gives you a little bit of a sense of where this was taking place. So most likely Paul is dragged from that temple to the barracks, gives that message, and eventually then is taken to Caesarea. So let's, if we can, now look at Caesarea for a few minutes, and then I will turn it back over to Paul, to Parker for just a few minutes. But let's look at this. And that is, this whole area, not so long ago, was pretty much covered with sand. And as you can see, it was easy to just sort of ignore. But over time, the Israeli Department of Antiquities began to dig into that area and found that there was a lot more than they would have expected to be actually be in Caesarea. And so one of the things you begin to see is that there were attempts to try to make it look very Roman. So that is, for example, like the theater. This part here was built up, but the rest of it was pretty flat. And there at one time was a harbor out here that was created. I'll show you that picture in just a minute. And so that is an aerial view of what we're going to be looking at now for a couple of minutes. The first, and I showed this to you last time, is that we have the theater, the Roman theater here. Then you have these fairly high gates around Caesarea, and that's why Paul was taken there, so that if there was an attempt on his life, they could protect it. The temple of Augustus is here. then the palace of Herod is here. And because this is a really sandy beach, they had to literally construct a harbor. And so as a result, this was all dug out, and they created this area where then ships could come in from the north. Now, I never understood this until I watched this week one of the other guides who was talking about why they did this the way they did. It turns out that in the south, the Nile River puts all sorts of sand out into the Mediterranean Sea. You would think most of it would eventually filter out, but some of it comes all the way up here. And so the southern part here would very quickly fill up with sand if they had not dug it out. So the goal was to always have the ships. Now, you can see there's got one picture of a ship right here. So there's ships, you know, with very flat bottoms could maybe dock here. But all the other ships would come in from the north so that it wouldn't be clogged up with all the kind of sand. So that's why the entrance to that harbor. And there are estimates that sometimes there were a couple hundred ships in here. It must have just been as crowded as it possibly could have been. But this was, again, became a seaport that was literally created by Herod, and it was named for Caesar Augustus. So then, of course, you have that. The temple to Augustus. You also have over here another forum, and you have an aqueduct we'll look at in just a minute, because when Caesarea was first built, there was enough water using the wells, but now as the population grew dramatically, they had to actually bring in water from about 10 kilometers away in order to actually provide enough water for those living there. Let's, if we can, then look at something that has been developed. This week when I sent out my promotion, I mentioned the fact that might give you a little bit of maritime archaeology. In a couple of weeks, when we look at Acts 27, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what Bob Cornuke has done, in which he believes he has found the anchors of Paul. In Acts 27, what you have is this shipwreck that Paul is part of. They dropped two of their anchors, which had been found before, but they had not found the other two, and using some of the biblical narrative in Acts 27, went and looked and found two more anchors, brought them to Texas A&M, of course, to validate whether or not those were of that same period of time and those kinds of things. So we're going to talk about how maritime archaeology has become very significant. And as you can see, we've got individuals now that have been digging into the silt and underneath certain things, finding all sorts of potential artifacts. And here are just a few of the ones that they have found just there in Caesarea. Matter of fact, I saw a picture, interesting enough, this actually in the sand just before they pulled it up. And so you can see that these are the things they're finding in and around Caesarea. You might say, what's this over here? Well, that's money. That's just coins just all stuck together, all these Roman coins and things of that nature. So as we're not only digging into the earth, but we're going down into the silt, we're finding more and more archaeological evidence there in Caesarea. Pretty interesting. Well, let's, if we can, now look at this area, which at that time most likely was where Herod's palace was. That's one angle that you can see a little bit. Here's another better one. These obviously were not there when they dug them up. They put them up just to give you a sense of what it would have been like. And you might, as a matter of fact, say, well, where did the palace go? Well, when it was destroyed, it was used to build something else. And in the distance, what you have here is a fortress that was built during the Crusades. And that's a Crusader fortress. I have not been to that. I know Gary Fraser has, and I've watched some of his videos. And so most likely some of the material that was here in Caesarea was used later to build a fortress. Why did they build the fortress? Because they were fighting against the Muslims. Eventually they were pushed out by Saladin, and that was then abandoned for a while. But there's a minaret over here, so I suspect the Muslims eventually took over some of that and used it for their purposes. So you might say, well, where did all this go? Well, some of it was probably looted, some of it was ransacked. Some of the building materials were used to build another fortress just to the north there of Caesarea. Let me, if I can, again, maybe show you some of the other aspects of this. This is a 3D animation that helps us understand a little bit more of what the Hippodrome looked like and what the actual theater looked like. The Hippodrome was a place where all sorts of athletic contests took place, but most likely had a place where there were horse races, chariot races. If you've ever seen Ben-Hur, this is a reconstruction of what it most likely looked like. The evidence of it, I'm going to show you an aerial photo in just a minute, still gives you a pretty good sense of what it is, but the various areas around here have been destroyed, but you can still get a pretty good sense of what it was like for individuals who wanted to watch an athletic contest, watch a horse race, watch a chariot race. They would actually come and they would fill these seats. And so again, it almost felt like you were in Rome, even though you were in kind of the northwestern part of Israel. And again, you can see some of the columns that most likely were there at the time. And this was a place for entertainment, perhaps also a place sometimes used for various kinds of other spectacles and celebrations. And there is particular obelisk to actually honor Caesar Augustus. This is now going to the theater, and we saw the round part of the theater. The other part was destroyed, but this was something that was like the stage. So behind the scenes, actors would get into costume. Sometimes they would roll out various sets, and this is what was on the one side. If you were actually coming out as a actor, you would come and see this particular theater. And they have reconstructed that theater to this day so that you can get a little bit of an idea of what it might have looked like at the time. Just before we run out of time, let me cover a couple more real quickly. This gives you a picture of the Hippodrome from an aerial view. I had to get these off of line. Would be nice to get Parker over there with his drone to take some of those of ourselves. Wouldn't that be great? But so far I have that. And again, just to give you a sense, the theater is over here. Herod's palace is over here. But look how large this is. In a minute I'm going to show you some of the warehouses were here. The warehouses were not only used to maybe store, it could have even been some of the fighters and some of the horses, but also the enormous amount of food and resources coming into the harbor. The harbor at one time actually had all of it constructed. There was an earthquake that destroyed that, so that's why they're digging now into the water to find the pieces that fell during the earthquake. But this gives you a sense of just the incredible work that was developed there in terms of the warehouses where food was stored, probably where some horses were stored as well, and all of that existed along kind of that seashore area as well. As I mentioned, the aqueduct actually takes water from about 10 kilometers to the north to there. And then because there was so much, there was actually a second aqueduct that was developed for a while. But this is what's left of it. And actually, as some of you might have seen if you've gone online, you can walk under that. This is a huge structure that still remains to this very day. Last time I mentioned some of the archaeological benefits of this, one of these is this is a reconstruction of what is actually in the Hebrew Museum. But if you look really closely, you see the word Pilate right there. And so it shows us that Pontius Pilate was honored there in Caesarea. So it's actual archaeological evidence that Pontius Pilate existed, and he was a prefect, and we found that right there in Caesarea. I mentioned this last time that as they're uncovering some of these mosaics, they found this. And this is the most recent discovery that was just online just recently. Some of the other things is they are just digging down bit by bit. It's a painstaking process to make sure they don't ruin any of the mosaics. This gives you a sense that even to this day, you want to volunteer and go and help dig out what's there in Caesarea. It is pretty amazing what we've been able to find. But again, in the interest of time, I wanted to give Parker enough time for some of the pictures. But if you find yourself saying, that was pretty interesting, I'd like to know a little bit more about Caesarea. There's a very good chapter in this book, In the Steps of St. Paul. And as we've been making our way through the book of Acts, I've been sort of taking you through with a lot of pictures some of the things that you will find in that book. And so I would highly recommend it. Parker?